Hi, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders coming up for you today with none other than James Dellingpole. But before we do that, I just want to let you know two ways that you can support this show. First off, please do give us a positive rating and review with your podcast provider. It takes 30 seconds, it costs you nothing, and it's a great way to help us reach new people. Second, if you can afford it, please do consider making a donation to Spiked, ideally in the form of a regular donation. Last Orders, like all of Spiked's content, is free for all. So we rely on the generosity of our readers and our listeners to keep us going and growing. Even £5 a month is a huge help. So if you haven't already, do take a second to give us a rating and a review. And if you don't donate to us, but you'd like to, please do sign up today. Just go to spiked-online.com and click on that big red donate button in the top right corner to do so. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship. And these days, there's a lot about coronavirus too. In this episode, we discuss the prospects for lockdown 2.0, the pushback against corona authoritarianism, and the latest from Britain's culture wars. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater and today I'm joined as ever by Chris Snowden of the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello Chris, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm not too bad, thanks for asking.
Excellent. And today we're delighted to be joined by James Dellingpole. James will be known to many of our listeners, I'm sure, as the writer, the columnist, the polemicist and the host of the Dellingpod podcast. James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm super excited, as they say, to be here.
Excellent. So we're going to be talking a lot today about COVID and lockdown, civil liberties, a bit of culture war too. But first, let's start on the corona situation in the UK. Because Chris, last month, we dared to have a bit of a good news episode. Whereas this month, all the news is bad. We've seen a rise in coronavirus cases. And in response to that, more of these unprecedented restrictions, not so unprecedented these days. We've had the rule of six implemented, more local lockdowns, 10 p.m. curfew on pubs and restaurants, calls for nationwide ban on household mixings, lockdown 2.0 being mooted, of course. I think we'll come on to lockdown itself and whether that's coming back properly in a moment. But to kick off, what do you make of the latest restrictions? You know, are they justified? Will they work?
I don't think they're justified. I don't think they'll work. But I am actually, ironically, a bit more optimistic than I was, because I just think the whole thing is now so obviously unworkable that it has to fall apart. And it gives me some pleasure to see thousands of people at 10 o'clock at night kind of drinking and partying up and down the country. And things will get worse before they get better, because the government, I think, now will, for example, probably ban off licenses selling alcohol after 9 o'clock. They may at some point try and bring in the military in some way. I wouldn't be surprised. They're going to go for more and more stringent measures. It seems fairly clear that the strategy, such as it is just to keep the number of infections as low as possible. And I think they really have exhausted the public's patience, particularly young people. You know, the penny has dropped now with young people. This disease is basically of no real threat to them whatsoever. I think the government made a big mistake by extending lockdown into May and June, because the benefits in terms of reducing transmission at that point were diminishing returns. They were pretty negligible. But it really exhausted a huge amount of capital and trust from people, after which they felt they'd really done their bit and they weren't going to do all this again. And they're not going to do it all again in lockdown. People would, I think, now just rather take their chances. And I know that surveys still show, you know, there's a decent majority of people who think actually the government should be going further. But there's still many millions of people who think the exact opposite. And even if they say one thing to a survey, they seem to be displaying different behavior when push comes to shove. So I think things are going to get worse. I think we probably will have a second lockdown at some point. Certainly, I think the north of England will have a lockdown. But there is now a sense, I think, a tangible resistance amongst the population. You know, the idea that the government's going to cancel Christmas, going to cancel New Year's Eve parties, it's not. The government just can, you know, this is a thin blue line we're going to see broken here. You can't control 68 million people like that. We're not a police state. We don't have enough police officers to be a police state. So I think there's more and more resistance to it. And I think eventually the government is just going to have to give up on this.
James, what are your thoughts? Do you think there's as much grounds for optimism as Chris was laying out there, or are things just going to get a lot worse?
It was the most world-weary optimism I think I've ever heard. it was like so optimistic. It was almost pessimistic. I hope Chris is right. My kids, certainly, mind you, that they're not exactly an unbiased sample, are they? I suppose they've been indoctrinated by me, but they're both at university at the moment, and they really are just thinking that these measures being introduced by the authoritarian state are risible. And you know, they're a challenge to be got over rather than rules to be obeyed. I got a call from my daughter last night saying, "Dad, if I get fined by the police, are you going to pay? You're going to pay, aren't you?" the police have been targeting, that they've been trying to frighten students, and they've been making examples of students. I mean, my daughter tells me that several of her friends have actually been busted by the authorities, whether by the police or whoever, and had fines put on them. So I reckon this is probably coming from Dominic Cummings. This sounds like classic Dom, as they say. And I used to think classic Dom was a good thing, because I thought Dominic Cummings was our man who was going to destroy the deep state. He was going to reform the civil service. But what I didn't realise is that Dom is also our fascist leader in waiting. That the threat, for example, to bring in the army, that apparently was Dom. And I think that this is where I agree with Chris. I think it is going to get worse. I think, and I hope he's right about, if you push the people too far, there's going to be resistance. We kind of saw a taste of this at the anti-lockdown rally, whatever you want to call it, in Trafalgar Square on Saturday, which I went to. And you had a crowd of very, very peaceful people, really just kind of minding their own business. And a very mixed crowd. A lot of them looked like crusties to me, looked like the kind of people you'd see at an XR rebellion. And I quite liked that. I quite liked that diversity. You know, there were lots of black people there. There were lots of white people, old people, young people. And we were just gathering in Trafalgar Square and half-heartedly, in some of our cases, listening to David Icke, whoever was speaking. And I went off to get a McDonald's because I was thinking, well, nothing doing here. It's just a nice, friendly get-together. And then while I was away, two lines of police on either side of the National Gallery moved in aggressively and started pushing, you know, old ladies over and things. It was weird. And I got eyewitness reports from the people who'd been there and experienced this heavy-handed police action, entirely unnecessary. I mean, there was the reason they gave was that people were breaching the social distancing rule. Well, all they had to do was saying, "This is the police. You are breaching the social distancing rule. Please, can you disperse now?" They didn't do that. They'd already planned their charge. And then what they were trying to do, I think, was provoke the crowd into defending themselves so that they could then send in the harder helmeted bully boys afterwards, having, you know, to defend their police brothers. It's all very, very dodgy. This is the kind of thing we learned about at school, about the rise of authoritarianism in various forms in the 1930s. And, you know, people invoke Godwin's law at this point. But I'm saying this is how history happens. These things suddenly appear from nowhere. And the feeling I get is that a small cabal of people in the government now are trying to rush this stuff on us before we can gather our senses and have time to resist. They're trying to terrorize us into obedience. And I don't think this is the British way. And I don't think ultimately the British people are going to tolerate this. I hope they won't.
Chris, just on that, because, you know, it's often dismissed as quite alarmist to say that the government might get used to this state of affairs, might get used to legislating in the way that it has, basically by ministerial decree, might get used to meeting a crisis by clamping down all of our liberties. But isn't there a fear here and a rightful concern that they might just get used to this? This might become the means through which they address all kinds of crises, you know, even beyond the coronavirus issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to imagine they would do the same thing if there's rumours of another dangerous flu coming out of China or somewhere. I don't tend to think of this as being, you know, something that the government has secretly always wanted to do, and they're taking their chance. And I don't think that it would succeed even if there was a plan, you know, because we have a free press, and as James says, this is not British at all. There is, of course, a danger that it will keep some of this stuff in. I don't know which particular bits. I'm sure the public health lobby would like to keep the pubs closed at 10 p.m. for one thing. They use this as an excuse to bring in their anti-obesity stuff, I guess, but in a way, I'm not as worried about what's happening in the long term as in the short to medium term. You know, I think they have got carried away, they being the government, have got carried away with trying to suppress this virus. They have, the penny hasn't dropped that they can't really do it. And they are going to use more and more draconian measures to keep people in line. It's very obvious to me that the consent is just gradually dripping away. And they think because people went down to lockdown so easily, and they were very surprised. If you look at the Sage Minutes, they were amazed how easily people went into lockdown. It's one of the reasons they didn't want to have a lockdown in the first place. They didn't think it was possible in a country like Britain. They've been surprised how quickly people went into lockdown, but they haven't really twigged that that was because people were terrified of the virus. And they didn't need much encouraging to go into lockdown. But now things are very different for the reasons I mentioned before. They are losing consent, and so they're having to make up with it by unleashing the hounds.
And the media, which has behaved abysmally throughout this, as I might say, have certain alleged libertarians, people who ought to have been of our party, have failed us dismally, have wet the bed, and worse.
Naming no names.
We know exactly who they are. And I wonder whether they even understand the concept of libertarianism. But let's go to our media. The media have, I mean, only, I think, recently the Sunday Sport has been the exception. Is it the Sunday Sport that's taken us aside? But the government has bought our free, frank and fearless media. And only recently, only in the last couple of weeks, I think, have you had articles. So some of the licensed lunatics like myself or whoever, you know, the licensed right-wing loons have been allowed to suggest that maybe the lockdown was a huge mistake and maybe the evidence doesn't support these measures. But it's starting to creep into the news pages now. And I think that gives me a little bit of hope, because there was a wealth of evidence to show that this is a massive overreaction to essentially a non-existent problem. And by that, I mean, if you get coronavirus and you're in a, you know, you're over 18, you've got various underlying health conditions, then you probably fit into the category that one cynically might call dry Tinder. You know, you're waiting for the Grim Reaper to carry you away. And if it wasn't coronavirus this year, it'll be influenza last year or the next year. That's how it works. But in terms of history, there has never been such a big overreaction, I think, by any governments in history. For example, have you ever met anyone who remembers 2000 and says, oh, do you remember the influenza epidemic of 2000? Those were dark times to live through. No one even remembers it was a really bad flu year. 2018, only 40,000 fewer excess deaths in 2018 than there were this year. So we're talking really quite tiny numbers. And yet the might of the state, of the authoritarian state, has been forced down on us. And I don't know how we're going to get out of this situation. I mean, the governments have acquired a taste of blood. They realize how much they can get away with. And I share Chris's concerns that any new virus that comes out, they're going to use it as an excuse to bring out the muzzles again and bring out the curfews. It's very worrying.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. I think it's interesting that there has been this kind of outbreak of common sense in the media, or at least an outbreak of a tolerance for dissent that we didn't see previously. You know, you're seeing people like Professor Carl Hennigan get a lot more media time they did previously. Even the BBC putting out some good pieces on do we have to live with COVID? All of this is quite interesting. But Chris, at the same time, we are coming up against this kind of bombardment of quite scaremongering messages coming from the government again. Last week, we saw the Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, Chief Science Officer, Patrick Vallance, give this kind of PowerPoint presentation to the nation with no questions from the media, talking about there being 50,000 cases a day by October if we don't take any action, pretty widely understood as rolling the pitch for the government to introduce new restrictions. What did you make of that particular press conference, that particular moment?
Well, it's propaganda designed to, again, create some consent. They see consent slipping away, and so they need to be more and more hysterical. I personally thought Valance and Witty were reasonably honourable in the early stages of the pandemic and came across as being fairly honest and sensible. And that extrapolation, quite a wild extrapolation, based on there being a doubling every 7 days, which hadn't really been, was dodgy dossier territory, as far as I could see. I have to say, I don't blame them for not taking questions from the media, though. I mean, they've clearly learned the lesson that the journalists, mainstream journalists, are just not interested in science at all. They only want to ask stupid point-scoring questions about Barnard Castle or whatever. So I don't blame them for that. But yeah, they were actively using their position in order to stoke a panic, because they realise they need more panic if they're going to get consent.
And what about you, James? What was your response to all that?
I think that what we're witnessing now across Europe, and I'm sure in America as well, I'm sure it's the same problem around the world, we're witnessing what's known as the case-demic. The pandemic ceased long ago. Because more people are testing, we are getting a lot more people testing positive, whether it's a false positive or a genuine positive. But we're not seeing a corresponding rise in deaths. I mean, sure, there's been an increase in deaths, but it's not anything that healthcare systems around the world can't manage. And what worries me slightly, I was having a chat the other day to a conservative MP. I'm not going to name him, but he was one of the kind of sounder elements in the Conservative Party, you know, a sort of outspoken backbencher, one of the Spartans. And he was saying to me, James, what you've got to realise is that this is serious. And I refer you to an article that appeared on Conservative Home that was written by my favourite epidemiologist. And you realise that there could be a second wave, which could lead to a spike in hospital cases. And if there is a spike in hospitalization, it could mean that the NHS is overwhelmed, and this could affect you and your family, James. And I was thinking, A, what planet have you been living on where the NHS has been open for business for the last 6 months? Because I certainly ain't had that experience, you know, or even try getting a doctor or trying getting a dentist or try seeing a sports physio. It's been really, really difficult. And secondly, absolute arrant bollocks. There is no danger, and you can quote me on this, there is not going to be a second wave except one that has been manipulated by false data, by essentially all those healthy kids, for example, in Manchester right now, healthy young people who are not going to be affected in any way health-wise by getting coronavirus. They've tested positive, and they've been locked up like prisoners in their squalid digs. God, I feel sorry for them. God, I think if ever there was a better way of ensuring that the youth never votes Conservative ever again, this is the one. And for what? I mean, yeah, it's like going around testing people for colds and finding that, lo, some people have got a cold and that therefore we should lock down the economy. These people are healthy. They should not be counted as evidence that we're going to hell in a handcart and the government should do more to clamp down.
But Chris, on that, is there nothing in this argument that whilst there are, as we know, populations who are not going to be susceptible to have bad disease, you know, they're very unlikely to even have symptoms in many cases, that you can't really just bifurcate the population, you can't keep young people away from older people indefinitely. Is there nothing to that argument as to why we do need to be a bit more restrictive on the broad stretch?
Well, I wrote an article for The Critic about this, because this is the argument you always get now, isn't it? And there'll be people listening to what James just said saying, yes, but they'll kill their grandmothers and that. Well, firstly, in the specific case of students, they will not be seeing their grandmothers until Christmas. That's 3 months away. This is a very, very good time
to do that.
If they're allowed to do that, yeah. I mean, so this is actually a very good time for them to be getting basically harmless COVID. But on the broader point, I mean, the alternative is everyone gets locked up, right? We can either try and self-isolate the vulnerable and the old for 2 or 3 months and let it spread around the rest of the population, which looking back is what we should have done in March anyway, or we can lock everybody up. Now, you'd have to be a real egalitarian to think it's better to lock everybody up than to lock up a few people. Now, my solution would be not actually locking anybody up, but saying that this virus is going to be circulating, maybe a bit more than it was before. If you are old and vulnerable, you've probably in practice been self-isolating for the last 6 months. It's been bloody miserable and you want to see some kind of end to this. But whether you have or not, this is the risk, right? Let's make people aware of the risk. David Spiegelhalter did some fascinating research recently in which he showed that no matter what age you are, getting COVID, not just being around in a society where the disease is circulating, but actually getting COVID only adds a normal year's worth of risk to your life. And that's why the risk is greater when you're older, because people, a normal year of life when you're 85, you know, is much more risky than a normal year of life when you're 18. But whatever age you are, it's only like living another year. Are we prepared to sacrifice a whole year, essentially, write it off, maybe more than a year, in order to protect ourselves from 1 year's risk? I think if given that information, most people, including most old people, and I know I can speak for my parents, for example, in this regard, would rather take their chances. So what we should be saying, and the government would never do this, but I think this is what it should do, is we should say, right, the disease is now going to circulate. We are not going to be destroying our livelihoods and our social lives and the economy to try to suppress something that can't be suppressed. It is going to be out there. If you are concerned about that, if you want a second lockdown, you lock down. You personally lock down for maybe the next 2 or 3 months. And by the time you come out of this voluntary lockdown, you'll actually find the country is a hell of a lot safer place than it was when you hid yourself away. But the alternative is effectively very vulnerable people are locked down indefinitely. And then at some point, everybody's locked down again.
Chris, that was music to my ears. I totally agree that they should end all lockdown. It should be entirely voluntary. And my parents too, both of whom are undoubtedly in vulnerable categories, would say, I'd rather take the risk. I'd rather see my grandchildren. I want a normal life. I want to play golf. I want to go on walks on the Malvern Hills, whatever my parents do. They don't like this oppression. It's not the country they recognise. Also, the other advantage of Chris's let it rip scheme were implemented would be that we would no longer have to hear one of the most nauseating forms of modern virtue signalling is, what would you call it? It's a sort of altruistic hypochondria, where every time you talk to somebody about the coronavirus, half the time they've got this elderly relative or my partner or my, you know, my whatever, my child. And then they'll go into great detail, tedious detail about this special condition that their parent or child or brother or cousin has got, which means that they have to be very careful and they have to lock down. In fact, I suspect that if all these people, all these terrible cases were exposed to coronavirus, I reckon a vanishingly small percentage of them would actually die. I think probably what would happen is what happened to me. You know, you'd think you've got a bit of a cold and you feel a bit rotten for 5 days and then it's over. I think we've reached this almost peak insanity, although I don't think we've reached the peak yet. I think it's going to get worse, but that is the solution. And it would be so easy for the government to say, wouldn't it? Okay, we've decided we're going to save the economy now. We're going to save all those people, start saving those people who are being untreated for cancer and all the other things because of this overreaction. We're going to treat the country like grown-ups and we're going to let you decide. You decide. I mean, what a great election ticket. We're going to let the people decide whether or not they want to hide and cower, like
take back control. Take back.
Hey, there's a good slogan.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. And on that note, let's move on to some other topics here, particularly some recent developments in Britain's never-ending culture war. So this past week, there's been two potential appointments to Ofcom and the BBC to chair those two venerable institutions, which sent Twitter into meltdown. So Paul Dacre, former editor of the Daily Mail, has reportedly been asked to run the broadcasting regulator Ofcom. Lord Moore, former editor of the Daily Telegraph, biographer of Margaret Thatcher, no less, believed to be considering accepting the role of chairman for the BBC. So, James, there's been a hell of a lot of outrage over this. I saw so many people declaring this basically the end of Britain. But what did you make of those two potential appointments?
Well, I think top trolling Boris. I mean, I have zero faith in Boris. But those suggested appointments are almost Trumpian in their magnificence. It would be awesome if Dacre were put in charge of Ofcom, and it would be awesome if good old Charles Moore were made chairman of the BBC. Will it happen? I don't know. I think it could only tend towards the good. I mean, the problem is that I think we can all agree on this, that the social justice warriors or whatever have made such running in the culture wars over a period of decades. There is so much ground to be clawed back. There is not an institution in Britain, and that includes the army, by the way, which has not been heavily SJW converged. Every institution in Britain now has lost its original purpose. So, for example, give you one example, the National Trust. The National Trust was established in 1895 to preserve some of our historic buildings for the nation and preserve certain kind of cherished landscapes and stuff. What does the National Trust do now? What are its main preoccupations? It doesn't really want visitors visiting these places very much. What it wants to do is to generate newspaper articles about how it's waging war on colonialism and how it's found evidence that such and such a property has connections with the slave trade. It previously wanted to sort of make sure it was involved in doing its bit to ban fox hunting. It's making a stand for LGBTQH, whatever, QZ or whatever, but it's not actually doing its main purpose. You can apply this to every institution across the country. The police won't police properly. The British Museum, get this. The British Museum actually removed a bust of Sir Hans Sloane. Sir Hans Sloane, the guy whose collections were the basis for the Natural History Museum, the collection at Kew Gardens, the British Museum. In other words, the guy without whom we would not have such great museums, such great collections. And they've decided now that because of his dodgy activities in an era when slave trading was going on, that therefore he ought to be persona non grata. And don't even get me started on the removal of the shrunken heads from the Pitt Rivers Museum. I mean, what an act of cultural vandalism. These people, these curators of our museums, you think back to Victorian era, where the heads of museums, the head of the Ashmolean Museum of Oxford, what was he doing? He was decoding Linear B. He was improving our knowledge of the past. Can you imagine his modern equivalent? They're not doing that anymore. They're social engineering. They don't care about artifacts or history. They just care about social engineering, social justice. So there's much work to be done.
And Chris, don't you think the kind of abject horror in response to the prospect of two right wingers running the BBC and Ofcom just gave the lie to the idea that these things are thoroughly impartial institutions in the first place?
Yeah. Well, the BBC one in particular, yeah. Well, you got immediately BBC people saying, well, I'll just resign if Charles
Please, please.
Yeah, right. There's no, yeah, please do, for one thing. Where are you going to work with 5 million people unemployed? I don't know. But yeah, it kind of does suggest maybe, after all, there is a bit of a left-wing bias at the BBC. So I think that he would be a very good appointment. And I mean, as James has already kind of suggested, you know, there are a lot of these organizations that really need sorting out. This has been happening really while a lot of people have been, you know, napping. You know, this has been going on evidently for about 30 years while a lot of right-wingers have been complaining about things like political correctness, which in the great scheme of things actually was a pretty trivial issue. And we didn't realize it was this cultural revolution going on behind the scenes and all these various state organizations and state-funded quangos. I'm not quite so sure about Dacre. I mean, obviously the lefties hate Dacre, so you can enjoy a bit of schadenfreude from it. But he's, if I understand him correctly, he's a fairly censorious bloke. I mean, he's not really a libertarian. I'm not sure if I want, yes, the former editor of the Daily Mail to be in charge of what's allowed to be on television. But it riles the lefties, so I mean, I'm happy for it to be out there as a proposal.
Well, and another person who riles the lefties, of course, is Lawrence Fox. In the past week, plans of his have been revealed to set up a new political party, very much aimed at fighting the culture wars, provisionally to be called Reclaim, promising to, quote, make our future a shared endeavour, not a divisive one. So pushing back against this identity politics, it seems, this idea that Britain is just irreconcilably racist and a foul place to be. So it's already attracted a lot of interest, it seems, James, from Tory donors. Do you think this is another example of how, if at least it feels, even amongst the kind of Tory converted, that that party is incapable of kind of standing up for these things, standing up for these values such as they are?
I think there's very much a need for this new Lawrence Fox party. And I think that the Conservative Party yet again needs a kick up the arse. I mean, I think it's going to do for the culture wars what UKIP and Brexit Party did for Brexit. And I think there is a need for this party. A lot of the discussions I've been having with my libertarian drinking chums have been utter disappointment in the failure of Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party to oppose all this kind of authoritarian craziness is going on. You know, he's been fine about going to Dover and spotting lots of people coming across in boats. And, you know, that's his area. And, you know, I salute that. But he's been pictured out into the streets, clapping like a lobotomized monkey for our NHS. Only recently, when he started to sense where the wind's blowing and going, maybe we have now got a fascist government. Maybe I should do something. But he's been really slow to rise to the occasion. I think that we need a new party that can address all this authoritarianism through the medium of the culture wars. So I quite like this idea of that they're saying we're not left or right. I mean, even if we can just win on the culture war issues, that would be pretty good for me. And I think that we need parties like this to act as a stick in the wings, ready to beat all those conservatives like Johnny Mercer, who aren't really, you know, don't really believe in our history or our culture. They're just there to be in office, to be in power. So go Lozza, I say, and I really hope that the party takes off.
And Chris, finally from you, do you think a political party is the way to fight the culture war? Are there other ways that we potentially could push back against a lot of this nonsense?
I mean, I think a political party can be used usefully in this respect, but only as a pressure group, really, right? I mean, firstly, you can't expect Nigel Farage to bail the country out every time it's in problems. Right? So I don't expect Farage to have to do this one as well. I think he's done his bit really with UKIP and Brexit Party. And clearly, once you've got 3 or 4 million people who are prepared to vote for a party like this, then it has to shift the position of, in, let's face it, the Conservative Party, really. I mean, it might shift some of the other parties as well, but primarily they're aiming for the Conservative Party. So if you can emulate what Farage has done with Brexit Party and UKIP, then great. There is, of course, a danger that it just becomes a bit of an embarrassment because you're standing in elections and getting kind of 35 votes. So the history of small parties in Britain generally has not been particularly good. But I think on balance, it's a good thing. I mean, he'll presumably get a bit more exposure. People will be interested in him for a little while, at least. I mean, we can't do any worse than the Independent Group for Change, can he? So, I mean, good on him. Clearly, he's not going to become Prime Minister, but if he can get a conversation going and put a bit of pressure on the wets of the Tory party, then game on.
Excellent. Chris, James, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.